This yearning for what was and may never be again in this life gives the saga a tragic quality that lifts it out of the ordinary realm of fantasy.
Clover, we're back again.
Indeed we are. We've got chapter 8 of book 2 of Fellowship of the Ring, Leaving Lorien.
Yeah. What do we think of this one?
Melancholy, a time for parting.
Oh, yeah.
But I was thinking...
It's still really good, though.
I'm sure everyone's heard of the famous, like, 7 endings in the Lord of the Rings movies. How it just keeps ending. All the different storylines get wrapped up, which partly is, like, a necessity because this thing is so sprawling. But I was thinking about, for this chapter, this is kind of like the many beginnings. This is feels like now the finally they're setting off on the really hard part of the quest. Certainly they've already been on the quest. Gandalf's died, so
yeah,
they're on the quest already and it's intense, but this feels like another kind of beginning point.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say it felt like, you know, multiple endings here, because you'd think they said goodbye to, like, Galadriel and Celeborn, but then they keep turning up again, you know?
Maybe that's too.
Yeah, okay. All right, well, let's get into it. You got Cliff's notes?
Mm-hmm. So, it's time for the company to leave Lothlorien. It becomes clear that they do not have a clear plan for where they head next, east or west. Galadriel and Celeborn give them some wisdom, but not counsel. They wistfully gather their things, and the next day set out on foot with Haldir. After a long trek, they come to the banks of the rivers Anduin and the Silverlode. Here the elves, including Galadriel herself, give them many gifts. Well-stocked and rested, but wary of the journey ahead, they set off by canoe down the middle of the Anduin.
Nice. All right, cool. Okay, so we're just going to read the opening section here. It's kind of going to be like the plot going forward and some geography too.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll be the narrator this time. Then you can have Celeborn and I'll have everybody else. Okay.
All right,
here we go. That night, the company was again summoned to the chamber of Celeborn, and there the lord and lady greeted them with fair words. At length, Celeborn spoke of their departure.
Now is the time, he said, when those who wish to continue the quest must harden their hearts to leave this land. Those who no longer wish to go forward may remain here for a while, but whether they stay or go, none can be sure of peace. For we are come now to the edge of doom. Here those who wish may await the oncoming of the hour till either the ways of the world lie open again, or we summon them to the last need of Lorien. Then they may return to their own lands, or else go to the long home of those that fall in battle.
There was a silence.
They all resolved to go forward, said Galadriel, looking into their eyes.
As for me, said Boromir, my home lies onward and not back.
That is true, said Celeborn, but is all this company going with you to Minas Tirith?
We have not decided our course, said Aragorn. Beyond Lothlorien, I do not know what Gandalf intended to do. Indeed, I do not think he even had any clear purpose.
Maybe not, said Celeborn, yet when you leave this land, you can no longer forget the great river. As some of you know well, it cannot be crossed by travelers with baggage between Lorien and Gondor, save by boat. And are not the bridges of Osgiliath broken down, and all the landings held now by the enemy? On which side will you journey? The way to Minas Tirith lies upon this side, upon the west. But the straight road of the quest lies east of the river, upon the darker shore. Which shore will you now take?
If my advice is heeded, it will be the western shore, and the way to Minas Tirith, answered Boromir. But I am not the leader of the company. The others said nothing, and Aragorn looked doubtful and troubled.
I see that you do not yet know what to do, said Celeborn. It is not my part to choose for you, but I will help you as I may. There are some among you who could handle boats. Legolas, whose folk know the swift forest river, and Boromir of Gondor, and Aragorn the Traveler.
And one hobbit, cried Merry. Not all of us look on boats as wild horses. My people live on the banks of the Brandywine.
That is well, said Celeborn. Then I will furnish your company with boats. They must be small and light, for if you go by water, there are places where you will be forced to carry them. You will come to the rapids of San Gabir, and maybe at last to the great falls of Raros, where the river thunders down from Nenhitho, and there are other perils. Boats may make your journey less toilsome for a while, yet they will not give you counsel. In the end, you must leave them and the river, and turn west or east.
Aragorn thanked Celeborn many times. The gift of boats comforted him much, not least because there would now be no need to decide his course for some days. The others, too, looked more hopeful. Whatever perils lay ahead, it seemed better to float down on the broad tide of Anduin to meet them than to plod forward with bent backs. Only Sam was doubtful. He, at any rate, still thought boats as bad as wild horses, or worse, and not all the dangers that he had survived made him think better of them.
"All shall be prepared for you, and await you at the haven before noon tomorrow," said Celeborn. "I will send my people to you in the morning to help you make ready for the journey. Now we will wish you all a fair night and untroubled sleep." "Good night, my friends," said Galadriel. "Sleep in peace. Do not trouble your hearts overmuch with thought of the road tonight. Maybe the paths that each of you shall tread are already laid before your feet, though you do not see them. Good night."
Okay, so a lot of plot there about like what they're going to do. They're going to take some boats down. But I think by far the most interesting part was Galadriel's last line.
Yes, that it's, well, specifically that the path may be set before you, though you don't yet know. The path may be set before you, although you do not see it.
Right. They have the choice to make at this point. Like, do they go east or do they go south all the way to Minas Tirith and chill out there with Boromir's friends first, and then they try to cut over to Mount Doom?
Mm-hmm.
And so now, like, they got the boats. And so if they're going to take boats, then they're just going to have to go down the river for a while, and they can kind of decide on the way there.
Yeah, which frankly seemed a little bit uncharacteristic of Aragorn, in my opinion, that Aragorn was like, "Oh, thank goodness, I don't have to make up my mind now. I can punt it for the future." But it does seem like wise to ponder things a little bit extra.
That's fair until we read the next section, which we're going to do. Galadriel told them all to just sleep easy because they don't have to decide tonight, but they don't sleep easy. They kind of hold a council about what they should do here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So,
I was just going to mention, fairly obvious, but just like the other forks in the road that we've seen in the past, like trying to cross Carathras and then ended up going through Moria, this is a clear evidence of the geography driving the plot at this point.
Yeah.
So, anyways.
All right, you want to take the company?
The company now took their leave and returned to their pavilion. Legolas went with them, for this was to be their last night in Lothlorien, and in spite of the words of Galadriel, they wished to take counsel together. For a long time they debated what they should do, and how it would be best to attempt the fulfilling of their purpose with the ring, but they came to no decision. It was plain that most of them desired to go first to Minas Tirith, and to escape at least for a while from the terror of the enemy. They would have been willing to follow a leader over the river and into the shadow of Mordor, but Frodo spoke no word, and Aragorn was still divided in his mind. His own plan, while Gandalf remained with them, had been to go with Boromir, and with his sword help to deliver Gondor, for he believed that the message of the dreams was a summons, and that the hour had come, at last, when the heir of Elendil should come forth and strive with Sauron for the mastery. But in Moria, the burden of Gandalf had been laid on him, and he knew that he could not now forsake the ring, if Frodo refused in the end to go with Boromir. And yet, what help could he or any of the company give to Frodo, save to walk blindly with him into the darkness?
"I shall go to Minas Tirith, alone if need be, for it is my duty," said Boromir. And after that he was silent for a while, sitting with his eyes fixed on Frodo, as if he was trying to read the halfling's thoughts. At length he spoke again, softly, as if he was debating with himself. "If you wish only to destroy the ring," he said, "then there is little use in war and weapons, and the men of Minas Tirith cannot help. But if you wish to destroy the armed might of the Dark Lord, then it is folly to go without force into his domain, and folly to throw away."
He paused suddenly, as if he had become aware that he was speaking his thoughts aloud.
"It would be folly to throw lives away, I mean," he ended. "It is a choice between defending a strong place and walking openly into the arms of death. At least that is how I see it."
Frodo caught something new and strange in Boromir's glance, and he looked hard at him. Plainly, Boromir's thought was different from his final words. It would be folly to throw away what? The Ring of Power? He had said something like this at the council, but then he had accepted the correction of Elrond. Frodo looked at Aragorn, but he seemed deep in his own thought and made no sign that he had heeded Boromir's words. And so the debate ended. Merry and Pippin were already asleep, and Sam was nodding. The night was growing old.
Okay, does that give you more insight into Aragorn's dilemma at this point?
Yeah, certainly.
Why he wouldn't be undecided, or why he would be undecided.
I mean, he's got the team on his back. He's undecided now because he's trying to play the role of Gandalf as well as what he was already planning to do.
Right.
And so he feels loyalty to what he sees as his quest, as well as helping Frodo at all costs in Frodo's quest.
So he feels like he has to be Gandalf since Gandalf's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But then again, he also, there was that line like, what help can he actually give to Frodo,
right,
you know, in the long run? Which I think is kind of borderline silly, actually, because like Frodo doesn't know where he's going at all. Aragorn would have an idea, you know.
At the
very least, he's a good compass. Second of all, he's like a good, you know, bodyguard protector. But overall, I guess if you're looking at it like, okay, well, you know, eight guys, five guys versus Mordor, yeah, Aragorn doesn't help out. Just like Glorfindel wouldn't have helped out if he was on this thing.
Yeah, it sort of takes the sneaking in versus fighting logic that what they discussed at the Council of Elrond. It sort of takes that to the extreme,
right,
where it's like, what can anyone do for Frodo?
Yeah, but it's also, he has allegiance to Gondor, like, you know, that's his, the land of his ancestors, home people. Like, he doesn't want to see that destroyed. Like, even if they defeat Mordor, if they don't do it in time, Gondor is wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, he doesn't want that to happen, right?
One other little note there is interesting, that this line, they would have been willing to follow a leader over the river and into the shadow of Mordor. But Frodo spoke no word, and Aragorn was still divided in his mind, suggesting very, very explicitly that the rest of the company are followers in this case, and Frodo and Aragorn are kind of at the helm of this thing and staying silent.
Well, of course, Boromir, you know, he's bold enough to be a leader, but he's not going to go across the river, period. You know, he's team Minas Tirith.
Right. I think he's bold enough to be a leader, but at this point he's back down to saying, like,
absolutely,
I'll do my thing, and, you know, you guys do what suits you, but...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what do we think of Boromir?
Clearly, getting a little shady. We've gotten the very faintest of implications before that he was not being totally forthcoming, and this certainly reinforces that.
Yeah, so it's that it would be folly to throw away line, and then obviously he's referring to the ring, no matter how he covers it up, right?
Right.
And I think this is actually, like, I think the first time where, you know, he did try to cover up his ways here, but like they brought up, he had said something like this at the council, and Elrond rejected the idea, and he kind of just went along with it, and mm-hmm. seemed like he really believed, like, okay, yeah, that's solid reasoning. Whereas here, it's like he says, like, well, maybe we shouldn't throw away the ring.
You know, maybe
we should, implying that we should use it, you know. And this time he doesn't quite back down from that idea, but he tries to conceal it.
Yeah, I actually misspoke. It's not that we got a faint glimmer during the Council of Elrond. I think he straight up revealed his intentions, where he said, let's use it and fight with it. And here he seems to be saying the same thing, and I think it actually does him a disservice to walk back on it.
Yeah.
It clearly suggests that he's hiding something instead of being a little more straightforward about his previous...
Right, because at the council, he didn't know any better, and it was a good thought, actually.
Right.
But, you know, for somebody that's inexperienced, but then now it is... This is like, okay, this one's shady.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But if we think back to it, you know, it could kind of make sense if you think back to it, like, why did he go north in the first place? It was all because he's trying to find help for Gondor. He's trying to find help for his kingdom that's on the brink of destruction, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so now he's freaking out because, okay, the ring, which is the mightiest weapon that we could have, sounds like it's just going to go straight into Mordor, which is like, oh, shoot.
Right. It sounds like a pretty terrible idea.
Right, yeah. And on top of it, too, like, he doesn't even have the consolation prize of Aragorn and the sword coming back. It sounds like he probably senses, like, yeah, Aragorn's going to have to go with Frodo. Like, he's not even going to come back to Minas Tirith to help us out either. You know, mm-hmm, so, like, mm-hmm. maybe this is elevating his freak out mode.
Yeah, and another interesting thing that happens right here is it switches to, like, Frodo, not, like, no longer omniscient, but, like, Frodo-focused narrator here, suggesting that, like, Frodo, it's Frodo who's aware of this weirdness or contradiction.
Well, the narrator kind of goes in, like, Aragorn's head a little bit too, you know, because Aragorn didn't have lines here. It was just saying lines for him.
Right. Yes, that's true. But after Boromir speaks, we kind of jump over to Frodo's thoughts. And Frodo's the only one who notices Boromir saying this, apparently. And, like, we don't have Aragorn there as kind of the objective baseline to check it against.
I bet Aragorn noticed he just had a poker face.
Maybe so, but we've got, what I'm thinking here is, like, we have a well-established trend of Frodo or whoever has the ring gets very paranoid about it. Yeah. And because we're relying on Frodo as the kind of the narrator right here, it makes this a little bit hazier. Like, it's harder to say definitively, is Boromir actually being distrustful or whatever, you know? Is this just Frodo's paranoia playing up something, a non-issue, and turning it into an issue?
Yeah,
and I kind of liked that Tolkien cut out, like, the reference that we would have gotten of a glance to Aragorn, because it leaves us guessing. Mm. Well, was it really the issue that was going on here? Like, you're reminded that Frodo's, like, not the most reliable narrator in this case. In the morning, as they were beginning to pack their slender goods, elves that could speak their tongue came to them and brought them many gifts of food and clothing for their journey. The food was mostly in the form of very thin cakes, made of a meal that was baked a light brown on the outside, and inside was the color of cream. Gimli took up one of the cakes and looked at it with a doubtful eye. "Cram," he said under his breath, as he broke off a crisped corner and nibbled at it. His expression changed quickly, and he ate all the rest of the cake with relish.
"No more, no more," cried the elves, laughing. "You have eaten enough already for a long day's march."
"I thought it was only a kind of cram, such as the dale men make for journeys in the wild," said the dwarf.
"So it is," they answered, "but we call it lembus, or whey bread, and it is more strengthening than food made by men, and it is more pleasant than cram, by all accounts."
"Indeed it is," said Gimli. "Why, it is better than the honey cakes of the Bjorning, and that is great praise, for the Bjornings are the best bakers that I know of. But they are none too willing to deal out their cakes to travelers in these days. You are kindly hosts."
"All the same, we bid you spare the food," they said. "Eat little at a time, and only at need, for these things are given to serve you when all else fails. The cakes will keep sweet for many days, if they are unbroken and left in their leaf wrappings, as we have brought them. One will keep a traveler on his feet for a day of long labor, even if he is one of the tall men of Minas Tirith." Okay. Big section. One of the classic Tolkien details.
Mm-hmm.
The lembus bread. Hell yeah.
Yes.
Oh yeah. Okay, so I got some notes here. We're actually not going to spend too much time on this because we already have it recorded. I don't quite know when we're going to release it, but there's basically, we did like a whole special about, well, the jumping off point is lembus bread, so that's coming out soon.
Are you allowed to spoil the significance of lembus bread?
Yeah, we're gonna talk about it a little bit here, but let's get into this like the correct way, not just come out with it.
Okay.
So they said it's called lembus bread or whey bread. So whey bread is the Sindarin name, and Sindar is one of the elf languages, right? Okay. And Quenya, the other elf language, the other big elf language, it's called life bread / bread of life. So what do you think that sounds like?
Sounds like communion bread to me.
Okay, correct, Clifford. Nice job. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Especially, I guess, like, the last time you receive communion when you're in, like, the hospital, like, dying, they usually call that viaticum, which means whey bread. So,
oh, interesting.
Right, so that, all right, so this is, I mean, we're starting to see, like, the explicit thing. Plus, bread of life, like, that's, Jesus literally called communion the blessed sacrament, you know, like, everything. Like, he said he's the bread of life, so.
Mm-hmm.
There's that one church song about it. I don't know. Maybe I'll clip it in here. We'll see. I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen.
So Tolkien, with his fascination with language, has embedded this very clearly.
Yeah. Well, I mean, not just fascination with language. Like, he devout, basically lifelong Catholic, right? And so.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Certainly with the significance has much more Catholic significance throughout, but just in the words for it, yeah, alone, he's woven it into the Elven languages.
Right. So even, well, so I'd say with the words alone, it's like, okay, that means he's explicitly doing this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
This is completely intentional, I'd say. There were examples, even in the 20th century, probably scientifically studied too, of people that later went on to be canonized saints, who basically lived on the Eucharist alone for long periods of time. And there's no, like, real scientific explanation for it, but, you know, like, only, like, a really spiritual explanation will do. And, you know, critics, when they later review these books, they try to get into, like, the science of the lembus bread, like, how it can feed you and everything, and that kind of pissed Tolkien off, or not kind of, that did piss Tolkien off, because he's just like, well, this isn't something that, like, you know, physically fills you up with, like, calories and nutrients and stuff. It's just, it nourishes you in some different kind of way, okay?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
again, you know, this is all like connected to the Eucharist in the Catholic tradition. And again, we did a whole special about it that's coming out, but we'll see throughout the book how this comes into play. But, you know, very important that we introduced it here.
So that begs the question for me, if the Lembas bread is like the Eucharist, what does that imply for us about the elves?
Yeah, I wouldn't think of them as priests. Like, you know, this is where you wouldn't want, like, the one-to-one, like, allegory.
Okay.
Yeah, this is something that's applicable. It's like, okay, this totally looks like the Eucharist, but, yeah, don't think that elves is, like, they're all ordained priests or whatever who's making this, right?
Okay.
But, yeah, I was thinking about that a little bit, too. But, yeah, communion's the central hallmark of Catholicism. Like, it's literally the most important thing because we believe that it's actually Jesus' real body present in that. And that's what you're eating. There was one good quote, actually. Let me say this quote, and then we'll just move on, because we got so much other stuff to do today, and we got a whole special about this coming up. He was writing to one of his sons when he was having like kind of like a faith crisis. And so this is one of the excerpts from his letter. "The only cure for sagging or fainting faith is communion. Though always itself perfect and inviolate, the Blessed Sacrament does not operate completely and once for all in any of us. Like the act of faith, it must be continuous and grow by exercise. Frequency is of the highest effect. 7 times a week is more nourishing than 7 times at intervals." So again, just if you read his letters, he just like, he comes back to that a lot. Like he'll bring up like the Blessed Sacrament, like you could probably count it on 2 hands how many times he brings it up, which is kind of significant for just excerpts from letters. Anyways, we got to keep going. Okay, next cool gift. This is the chapter of gifts. We forgot to say this stuff at the beginning. This is the chapter of gifts. All they get all the coolest stuff here. This is like when James Bond goes and gets like his gadgets for the movie from Q.
Right.
This is this episode.
Well, that's kind of why I feel like this is like another beginning.
Okay, you know? Fair.
Another launching off point.
Fair. Okay, so now we got the elven cloaks then. We got to read this section too, because it was cool.
"The elves next unwrapped and gave to each of the company the clothes they had brought. For each they had provided a hood and cloak, made according to his size, of the light but warm silken stuff that the Galadrim wove. It was hard to say of what color they were. Gray with the hue of twilight under the trees they seemed to be. And yet if they moved, or set in another light, they were as green as shadowed leaves, or brown as fallow fields by night, dusk silver as water under the stars. Each cloak was fastened about the neck with a brooch like a silver leaf, veined with silver."
"Are these magic cloaks?" asked Pippin, looking at them in wonder. "I do not know what you mean by that," answered the leader of the elves. "They are fair garments, and the web is good, for it is made in this land. They are elvish robes, certainly, if that is what you mean. Leaf and brooch, water and stone. They have a hue and beauty of all things under the twilight of Lorien that we love, for we put the thought of all that we love into all that we make. Yet they are garments, not armor, and they will not turn shaft or blade. But they should serve you well. They are light to wear and warm enough or cool enough at need. And you will find them a great aid in keeping out of the sight of unfriendly eyes, whether you walk among the stones or the trees. You are indeed high in the favor of the lady, for she herself and her maidens wove this stuff, and never before have we clad strangers in the garb of our own people."
Big stuff.
Yeah, it is.
Well, anytime we've get a first time ever or a never before.
Right, and we're high into the double digits of, you know, first time ever things on this
quest. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
but this is a cool thing. So this is true elven garments that they're getting.
Yeah.
That Galadriel, as we've previously discussed, among the most powerful and wisest characters in the entire Lord of the Rings and all of Middle-earth, actually took the time to help weave these things. So yeah. That's pretty amazing.
And then this brings up again the topic that we were talking about in the last chapter with magic again.
Yeah, we got the same response from the elves when Frodo and Sam were talking about magic and Galadriel showed up and she was like, "Well, I don't know what this magic you say is, but, you know, this might be what you call magic. But for me, it's just it's looking in this pool of water or whatever."
Right. These cloaks are the prime example of like the kind of like the good magic. They make something because it's beautiful, which usually, like, you know, good art is beautiful, so anything would qualify as that. But then this is also going to be useful, too, for good purposes. Like, it'll help them camouflage, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I should mention this last time, too, like, all this elf magic is kind of just an example of sub-creation. right? Which we've talked about before, but this is where it comes up again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Joseph Pierce has got the quote here. He said, the beauty of those things subcreated by the elves is so marvelous to the eyes of those who do not possess their subcreative gifts that there appears to be a magic in them. And yet, as the leader of the elves makes clear, their beauty is simply a reflection of the beauty of nature transfigured by the love with which the elves make things from it. Elves possess gifts of subcreation that are superior to those possessed by men or hobbits, but the gift is nonetheless natural to them and therefore not magical.
Mm.
Like the hobbits kind of have this too. Like they're really good at walking quietly through the forest so that men can't hear them. You know, like yeah. Wild animals can do this too, like deer and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I was reading the book some more and he was just casually referencing stuff. And I think like the best example of this actually would be like Michelangelo.
Okay.
You think about that guy. It's not like that guy had like a magic wand or some powerful spells that he was using to create all this stuff, right? Like all his art, like Sistine right. Chapel or like the Pietà or whatever, you know, right. like all this stuff or like the David one.
Right.
But you look at it and it doesn't seem like that's just a mere human achievement, right?
No, I mean, like at the age of 20, I think he would have already been recognized as like the world's greatest artist and architect and sculptor.
Right.
Makes me feel really great about myself.
But you know, like that really is just, it all comes like from his talent and his skill, you know. And of course he improved his artistic abilities too. Like you can see like prototype stuff of like some of his art.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it's fair to assume that they probably have prototype version of these elven cloaks that probably just weren't as good. Like even Galadriel had one that was like a lesser kind of crappy thing, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But the final product, which is what we see, you know, it's all under, like, their power, and they do that. But I think he also is, like, a good example of, like, highlighting the sub-creation element, because you look at all his most famous art and everything, and it's like, what's inspiring it? Like, think about it. Like, what's he doing it for? Like, what's he inspired by, besides, like, maybe getting paid? But even that, I don't think was his top priority.
Well, I mean, certainly religion.
Right.
Almost all of his art is religious in some fashion.
Yeah, exactly.
I take that back. I don't know if that's a factually accurate statement, but a lot of
his,
it is.
His biggest stuff is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's inspired by, and then he's also, not only is he inspired by the glory of God and like everything that he's creating there, mm-hmm. but then he's also doing it for the greater glory of God too. All right, so we're in the middle section here. We got to fly through some details. Also, though, just really quick, have you noticed the there's kind of like a good amount of symmetry going on between this book and book one? Like, you know, there was that rest stop in the middle with Bombadil, and then they were really, really sad to leave. Mm-hmm. Same thing's going on here.
Which was also sort of this Eden removed yeah. from time.
Yeah.
Like yeah. Lothlorien is.
And this is all comes after like the adventure had kind of just started beforehand, you know, and before that there was even just exposition of stuff, you know, for the first half of each book. Right. Okay. So that was probably kind of intentional. Maybe it was almost intentional just because he just needed a blueprint again. we'll see. There will be more symmetry throughout these books. Okay. Haldir comes to the company to guide their exit. So Haldir from two chapters ago, mm-hmm. who's the guy that let him in. Okay, Fellowship super sad to leave, and they could not count the days and nights that had passed in Lothlorien. It's interesting. We'll bring it up next chapter. Haldir brings news from the north that there's lots of war taking place, so they can't turn back that way even if they wanted to, and it's good that they're going south. Cool description of walking south to the edge of Lorien. Too bad we can't read it. It's at the bottom of page 361 and top of 362, if by chance you have whatever version of the book I have. They come to the angle. So, like, okay, so they get down to the actual edge where, like, the two rivers meet, you know, and obviously it forms the angle. We've mm-hmm. been talking about that the past two chapters. The two rivers are the Anduin, which is the Mississippi, and then the Silver Lode's kind of like the Missouri River flowing in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But giant convergence.
Yeah, yeah. And so the elves have three boats ready for him, and then Sam notices that there's elven rope in the boats. That's a little funny scene because Sam always wants rope, but we're going to skip it. We don't have time for that.
Similarly, similar to the elven cloaks, though, in terms of a magic, not magic
yeah.
type thing.
Right. Good to note because it'll come up, or maybe it won't. I don't know. Okay. Boats quote. Okay. I don't want to read the boat quote either.
Okay.
But there was something that said, like, the boats are unsinkable.
Yeah.
Which I don't really know how you can, like, if you really try, you could sink a boat, you know, like you can swamp it, you know?
Oh, of course.
Right, so, like, apparently you can't with these, maybe?
Well, I think it was just saying that they're very well designed, and even though they're super lightweight, they're somehow shaped in a way that it's very hard to flip them. I'm thinking, like, the, you know, like, some canoes and kayaks are kind of, like, really tricky to roll over, unless you're being stupid.
Okay, let's come back to it, because they might be actually unsinkable, even though the characters all act like they are sinkable for the rest of the time that they have these boats. But let's come back to that.
It would be an example of, yet another example of the elf stuff being magic, not magic.
Yeah, it could, yeah. But anyways, all right, so we talked about it. We'll come back to it. Okay, so boat one, Aragorn, Frodo, Sam. Okay, that makes sense. Boat two, Boromir, Merry, and Pippin. That makes sense. Boat three is Legolas and Gimli. Remember the last chapter, they started to become friends. I can only assume that that happened because Galadriel pierced Gimli's heart, you know, and so now he has new respect for all elves, and then Legolas also gave up his grudge, I would guess, you know? I don't know.
Right. They said they stood up for Gimli.
Right. They said they were now becoming fast friends.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So they do a practice session with all the boats, and all of a sudden there's this huge swan boat that comes down the river, and guess who's on it? Celeborn and Galadriel. Galadriel sing a song. You want to read the song?
Sure. This part I thought was interesting. One, the fact that they're doing a test run feels out of character with everything they've done so far. And if they're actually in unsinkable boats, it's kind of funny, but we'll take it. And then also yeah. this swan boat sounds awesome, but I can imagine Tolkien being inspired by, like, British countryside, like those swan paddle boats on a pond or something like that.
Yeah.
Or actual swans. I sang of leaves of gold, and leaves of gold there grew. Of wind I sang, a wind there came, and did the branches blew. Beyond the sun, beyond the moon, the foam was on the sea. And by the strand of Ilmarin there grew a golden tree. Beneath the stars of Ever-Eve, in Eldamar it shone. In Eldamar, beside the walls of Elven Tirion. There long the golden leaves have grown upon the branching years. While here, beyond the sundering seas, now fall the Elven tears. O Lorien, the winter comes, the bare leafless days. The leaves are falling in the stream, the river flows away. O Lorien, too long I have dwelt upon this hither shore. In a fading crown have twined the golden Eleanor. But if of ships I now should sing, what ship would come to me? What ship would bear me ever back across so wide a sea?
What do we think of the song?
I mean, Galadriel mourning her departure from Middle-earth, which we've discussed at great length.
Right. Thanks to the Galadriel special, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is her time's come. It's time for retirement, basically.
Yes.
Yes. And that's what you're picking up in the whole song, if you read it closely.
And remind me, where's Eldamar?
Eldamar is, it's one of the names for something that's in Valinor.
Okay, that's what maybe, I guess.
Yeah, like the elf.
She's dreaming of the trees
yeah.
in Valinor back right. at the very beginning of the Silmarillion.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, they have a final farewell picnic, but Frodo ate and drank little, heeding only the beauty of the lady and her voice. She seemed no longer perilous or terrible, nor filled with hidden power. Already she seemed to him, as by men of later days, elves still at times are seen, present and yet remote, a living vision of that which has already been left far behind by the flowing streams of time. That's a description.
Indeed.
Glad you'll just keep just sponging up the details that you're getting about her in these in these last moments. Okay, but we got to do the geography lesson. Another one from Celeborn. That's about all he's good for.
This sounds like a classic if you're like over at someone's house and the dad shows up to say goodbye and like gives you the directions back out to the highway or something.
You're right.
As you go down the water, he said, you will find that the trees will fail, and you will come to a barren country. There the river flows in stony vale amid high moors, until at last, after many leagues, it comes to the tall island of Tindrock, that we call Tol Brandir. There it casts its arms about the steep shores of the isle, and then falls with a great noise and smoke over the cataracts of Raros down into the Nindolf, the Wetwang as it is called in your tongue. That is a wide region of sluggish fen where the stream becomes tortuous and much divided. There the Entwash flows in by many mouths from the forest of Fangorn in the west. About that stream, on this side of the great river, lies Rohan. On the further side are the bleak hills of Emmanuel. The wind blows from the east there, for they look out over the dead marshes and the no-man lands to Cirith Gorgor and the black gates of Mordor. Boromir and any that go with him seeking Minas Tirith will do well to leave the great river above Rauros and cross the Entwash before it finds the marshes. Yet they should not go too far up that stream, nor risk becoming entangled in the forest of Fangorn. That is a strange land, and it is now little known. But Boromir and Aragorn doubtless do not need this warning.
Right. Okay, and so from there, so you had that whole geography lesson. We'll go through it as the book comes, but from there, they're warned particularly to avoid that Fangorn forest, and Boromir speaks up that he's heard all sorts of, like, wives' tales about Fangorn and how weird it is, and but nobody from Gondor's been there in years, so, you know, he can't verify any of it, but
This also seems like a little bit of plot symmetry from Mirkwood that we saw in The Hobbit, which was, you know, maybe once healthy and beautiful, but has become twisted and dark and mysterious, and then also the forest around Tom Bombadil's world.
Right.
Which was all both examples of sort of twisted, scary forest that there's myths and rumors of it kind of being able to suck you in.
Yeah. But of course, like, that's not a strange thing at this point either, that any land we don't know is probably weird at this point in all of Middle Earth, you know?
Right.
And he was particularly doing that with forests that we saw in The Hobbit. Like, that's what Mirkwood was based off of. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it was like that primeval forest in Germany, right?
Yes.
You know, or
yes.
Russia, whatever it was, you know. So yeah, so that's what he's drawn on. Anyways, they pass around a cup to drink, and Galadriel says she's got gifts for each of them. Okay. So yeah, gift given time, here we go.
We got the baseline gifts. The bread, the cloaks, the rope, the boats.
Yeah. Those are more like the utility tools or like the cool tools.
The stocking, you know, stuffers.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we gotta cover Aragorn first. Alright, this is a good one. Here is a gift of Celeborn and Galadriel to the leader of your company, she said to Aragorn, and she gave him a sheath that has been made to fit his sword. It was overlaid with a tracery of flowers and leaves, wrought of silver and gold, and on it were set in elven runes formed by many gems the name Anduril, and the lineage of the sword. The blade that is drawn from this sheath shall not be stained or broken even in defeat, she said. But is there aught else that you desire of me at our parting? For darkness will flow between us, and it may be that we shall not meet again, unless it be hence far upon a road that has no returning.
And Aragorn answered, Lady, you know all my desire, and long held in keeping the only treasure that I seek. Yet it is not yours to give me, even if you would, and only through darkness shall I come to it.
Yeah, maybe this will lighten your heart, said Galadriel, for it was left in my care to be given to you, should you pass through this land. Then she lifted from her lap a great stone of clear green, set in a silver brooch, that was wrought in the likeness of an eagle with outspread wings, and as she held it up, the gem flashed like the shining sun through the leaves of spring. This stone I gave to Celebrane, my daughter, and she to hers, and now it comes to you as a token of hope. In this hour, take the name that was foretold for you, Elisar, the elf stone of the house of Elendil.
Then Aragorn took the stone and pinned the brooch upon his breast, and those who saw him wondered, for they had not marked before how tall and kingly he stood, and it seemed to them that many years of toil had fallen from his shoulders. For the gifts that you have given me, I thank you, he said, O Lady of Lorien, of whom were sprung Celebrienne and Arwen Evenstar. What praise could I say more?
Okay, so are you catching up? What's going on here?
We mentioned before that Galadriel is Aragorn's mother, grandmother-in-law-to-be.
Yes. So right. So in our Galadriel special, I don't think we actually mentioned it while they were in Rivendell, because I think we forgot. but in the Galadriel special, we mentioned that Aragorn and Arwen's the daughter of Elrond, are a thing, you know, so they're basically betrothed, okay? And we'll cover that at some point in depth and do it justice.
And Celebrienne, Galadriel's daughter, is the wife of Elrond.
Yeah, okay. But she's passed over the sea at this point because she was attacked by orcs or whatever.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
But yeah, so this green stone, where have we seen this thing?
This is from the Silmarillion.
Kinda. We covered it more recently than that.
We talked about this in the Galadriel special.
Yeah, we did.
Yes.
Where was it?
This was I can't remember where this came from.
This is recorded in the unfinished tale. So, like, literally this tale was unfinished, right? Uh-huh. So Tolkien was writing this, and he didn't quite nail down the concept. But there was this idea that Arendil had a green stone, and that, like, helps the Havens. And then he sailed across the sea with it, and that also helped him get across the sea in addition to the Silmaril. And that stone was made by Celebrimbor, who's the one that made the three elven rings. You know, he's one of the Noldor's grandson of Fëanor.
He made the stone before he made all the rings.
Right, yeah, way before that. Because mm-hmm. he made the stone for Arendil. And then while they were waiting, before the rings were made, Galadriel was, like, sad about, you know, so many elves had left Middle-earth after the Silmarillion times. And so then she asked Celebrimbor, can you make another stone like that? And he uses that, and that's how she first starts, like, beautifying Lothlórien, like, make it this Edenic paradise, right?
Right.
But once she gets the Elven Ring, she doesn't need it anymore. So that's why she passes on to her daughter and passes on to Arwen. And now Arwen's giving it, through Galadriel, is giving it back to Aragorn as, like, you know, like a sign of hope. And Aragorn's looking all kingly when he gets it here. And then, like, if this actually still has power, like, maybe this is going to really help Aragorn, you know,
right,
with
right.
whatever task he has to do next.
And when she's saying, in this hour, take the name that was foretold for you, Elisar, the Elfstone of the House of Elendil, is the name of the stone Elisar, or is she saying that Aragorn's elf name or something is Elisar?
Both.
Both.
We'll cover that at some point.
Okay.
But yeah, good to point that out, but yeah, let's keep going.
Okay.
Okay, Boromir gets a golden belt, Merry and Pippin get silver belts, Legolas gets a new bow, such as the Galadhrim used, longer and stouter than bows of Mirkwood, and strung with a string of elf hair. Okay, my question though, wouldn't he have to, like, practice using a different weapon? I guess he's an elf, so maybe it wouldn't matter, but
I feel like if you were an expert bowsman, you can just, like, pick up a different size bow and get used to the strength of it.
Yeah, but even then, there's, like, some adjustment time just to get used to. Like, you can handle it, but, like, you're not used to, like, its range, right?
I don't know.
I'd say that he's an elf is the only justification for why he doesn't need to even test drive this.
You don't think it's just, like, you just have to pull it a little harder and then it shoots
further? They had to practice using boats, Clifford. Okay, anyways, we gotta keep going. Sam gets dirt.
But it's actually a pretty nice gift.
Yeah, why don't you read it?
Okay.
This one's worth reading.
For you, little gardener and lover of trees, she said to Sam, I have only a small gift. She put into his hands a little box of plain gray wood, unadorned, save for a single silver rune upon the lid. Here is set G for Galadriel, she said, but also it may stand for garden in your tongue. In this box there is earth from my orchard, and such blessing as Galadriel has still to bestow is upon it. It will not keep you on your road, nor defend you against any peril, but if you keep it and see your home again at last, then perhaps it may reward you. Though you should find all barren and laid waste, there will be few gardens in Middle-earth that will bloom like your garden if you sprinkle this earth there. Then you may remember Galadriel and catch a glimpse far off of Lórien that you have seen only in our winter. For only spring and our summer are gone by, and they will never be seen on earth again, save in memory.
Sam went red to the ears and muttered something inaudible as he clutched the box and bowed as well as he could. All right, so that was a fun one.
I was going to say, that's, like, got to be, like, that's the one of the more touching gifts.
Yeah.
Like, that was probably, like, from a gift-giving standpoint, I'd say the best gift. Not, like, the coolest thing, but it's, like, the best given gift. You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, it's pretty appropriate because Sam's a gardener, right?
I feel like the most thought had to go into it is what I mean.
Okay. Well, yeah, it beats the belt. Okay. All right, now we get to the fun one. Gimli's gift. Here we go. So we have to read this. This is, like, you know, you can't do this without reading it, right? Mm-hmm.
And what gift would a dwarf ask of the elves? Said Galadriel, turning to Gimli.
None, lady, answered Gimli. It is enough for me to have seen the land of the Galadhrim, and to have heard her gentle words.
Hear all ye elves, she cried to those about her. Let none say again that dwarves are grasping and ungracious. Yet surely, Gimli, son of Gloin, you desire something that I could give. Name it, I bid you. You shall not be the only guest without a gift.
There is nothing, Lady Galadriel, said Gimli, bowing low and stammering. Nothing, unless it might be. It is permitted to ask, nay, to name a single strand of your hair. which surpasses the gold of the earth as the stars surpass the gems of mine. I do not ask for such a gift, but you commanded me to name my desire.
The elf stirred and murmured with astonishment, and Kelborn gazed at the dwarf in wonder, but the lady smiled. It is said that the skill of the dwarves is in their hands rather than in their tongues, she said. Yet that is not true of Gimli, for none have ever made to me a request so bold and yet so courteous. And how shall I refuse, since I commanded him to speak? But tell me, what would you do with such a gift?
Treasure it, lady, he answered, in memory of your words to me at our first meeting. And if ever I return to the smithies of my home, it shall be set in an imperishable crystal to be an heirloom of my house and a pledge of goodwill between the mountain and the wood until the end of days.
Then the lady unbraided one of her long tresses and cut off three golden hairs and laid them in Gimli's hand. These words shall go with the gift, she said. I do not foretell, for all foretelling is now vain. On the one hand lies darkness, and on the other only hope. But if hope should not fail, then I say to you, Gimli son of Gloin, that your hand shall flow with gold, and yet over you gold shall have no dominion.
Damn, pretty big, pretty big. Okay, a couple things going on here. Alright, Galadriel special. What does this remind you of? Who's requested this gift before?
Fëanor wanted... Fëanor, the very... kind of the impetus of the whole Silmarillion story, right? Fëanor, crafter of the Silmarils.
Well, he got the idea to make the Silmarils from her golden hair shining.
Yes. He like thought that. It was the closest thing to the light of the trees in Valinor that he could capture.
Yeah. Did he get the hair?
No, she said no.
Three times she said no.
Yes. Instead, he went for his second choice, which was capturing the light of the two trees in stone, which turned into the most valuable gems in the entire Silmarillion. So clearly it's some special hair.
Okay, and so she had denied Fëanor three times, but now Gimli asked for a lock of hair, and then she's going to give him three instead here. So it's like, you know, again, hopefully the Galadriel special was not quite a long slog for nothing. Mm-hmm. So for these little parts here. Anyways, Gimli, you know, it's kind of funny. He didn't even ask for anything. Like, she commanded him to ask something. And so he's like, well, fine. Okay, this is what I want, you know. Mm-hmm. And he's going to cherish the hair, and the locks will be, like, an heirloom of his people and a symbol of goodwill between dwarves and elves. So it's like, excellent job, Gimli. Nice job. You mm-hmm. know, you're... This is a good ass. This is a good idea.
Yes.
Kind of weird, but good idea.
Yes. Weird indeed, but well played.
Yeah. Okay, so his reward, you know, after all of this too, his reward, Galadriel foretells, and she basically says at the end. And so now here, when they say at the end, obviously she's referring to whatever this conflict is at the end of Lord of the Rings, right? Mm-hmm. But you could also look at this as at the end, which is kind of like end times, which is known as like the eschaton, basically kind of like the apocalypse almost. I don't know. Kind of like when everything's set right. Like, this is what Christians believe will happen at the end of time.
Mm-hmm. Apocalypse in a good way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Basically, like, everything's set. I think I'm saying that right when I just leave it at that. Okay. Anyways, she's saying here, if everything goes well at the end, you're going to become very wealthy, and you're not going to succumb to greed either. You know, which is like, oh, nice job. Cool.
Right.
That's a good one, too. And then Fleming Rutledge has this quote here that was pretty good, so, and I thought it was cool, so I'll read it. Galadriel's gifts, then, are eschatological because they draw their powers not from what is, but from what will be, according to the divine mercy. We may say that Gimli is eschatological dwarf, meaning that by grace he is becoming what the dwarves are meant to be and will be in the promised kingdom of God. So, like, when everything's set right, dwarves will be, like, the ideal, right, of a dwarf, and that's Gimli here. Yeah, I think I should just leave it at that. I don't know. Do you have something to say?
No, that's an interesting reading, but that makes sense.
Yeah, kind of cool. Now we come to, obviously, the most important gift, so we'll read Frodo's here.
And you, Ringbearer, she said, turning to Frodo, I come to you at last, who are not last in my thoughts. For you, I have prepared this. She held up a small crystal phial. It glittered as she moved it, and the rays of white light sprang from her hand. In this phial, she said, is caught the light of a Rendil star, set amid the waters of my fountain. It will shine still brighter when night is about you. May it be a light to you in dark places, when all the other lights go out, remember Galadriel and Tremere.
Frodo took the phial, and for a moment as it shone between them, he saw her again, standing like a queen, great and beautiful, but no longer terrible. He bowed, but found no words to say. All right, very significant gift here. So what he got is, well, do you want to try to explain it, or should I just do it?
No, go for it. Okay. Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so obviously we know what a Rendil star is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, what is it? Say it.
Well, it's Erendil, his ship sailing across the heavens, yeah. Right?
Yeah, yeah. And what's like lighting that ship?
One of the Simrels.
Correct. Okay. So it's that light shining down onto the Mirror of Galadriel, which Sam and Frodo looked in last chapter. That light is caught in the water that's scooped up and put in this vial. So that's what this gift is. So he like has like a makeshift Silmaril almost.
Okay. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
But anyways, you know, she has the line here that you remember from the movie. May it be a light to you in dark places when all other lights go out. So that is the nature of the hope against hope. It continues when human possibility is at its end. Galadriel and Mirror. We didn't cover this last chapter, but it's more fitting to do it here. What does that kind of remind you of too? Especially think along the lines of like the Lembas bread.
Seems magic, but is not truly magic if we understand how the elves exist.
Think of Christian symbols again. That's the hint.
You have to help me out.
When you're a baby.
Oh, baptism.
Yeah. Okay. So that was kind of like a baptismal font almost, you know, like there's similar qualities, right?
Mm-hmm.
And baptism, that's when you're signed and sealed with God's everlasting covenant, protected by God in that instance. And that is what's actually contained in this file here. You know, so like that water, that baptismal water, that's what's in the file. You know, when all other lights go out, this is the hope against hope, you know, so like it's basically a sign and remembrance that you're part of God's covenant and protection.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, you know, it's a Rendil who's one of the biggest signs of hope in the Silmarillion too, probably the biggest actually.
Right.
Like when his star appeared, it was a sign for all the good peoples there. So yeah, so that's kind of what's going on here. Kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of this gift thing, I think this is also just another good time to bring up just some things to highlight and remember. There have been a ton of gifts in this book.
Yeah.
The whole story really started out with giving gifts at Bilbo's birthday party, because mm-hmm. the hobbits give gifts to everybody else mm-hmm. on your birthday. And of course, what he gave to Frodo was, well, Bag End and everything, but then most notably,
the ring,
right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fast forward, they go on this journey and everything. Gandalf basically gives up his life for the Fellowship. You know, that's already completed here. The Fellowship's giving, you know, like, these aren't quite gifts like you're giving to somebody, but, like, they're giving, right? They're giving up their whole lives, basically, to go on this quest. Mm-hmm. Like, hopefully they come out of it, you know, mm-hmm. fine. Mm-hmm. But who knows, right? I mean, Gandalf already has it.
Yeah. They're sacrificial gifts.
Right. And then, like, this whole quest itself, unlike basically any other quest ever, the goal of this one is not to gain something, but it is, again, to give it away or get rid of something.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. And hence we see the elves in line with the sacrificial gifts.
Right.
Galadriel's giving up presumably extremely valuable things that are... It's not just she has this, like, wealth of beautiful things that she's giving some of them away. She's giving away things that are presumably like kind of fundamental to her history and her being. Like the stone that she gives to Aragorn was fundamental to her and the creation of Lorien. And then even the cloaks themselves, the elves have never given to anyone else. It's like they're now giving their secrets and their strength onto these adventurers. It's like they're sacrificing some of the power and beauty of Lorien and the elves' creation so that they can kind of partake in this larger quest. Now the lady arose, and Celeborn led them back to the height. A yellow noon lay on the green land of the Tongue, and the water glittered with silver. All at last was made ready. The company took their places in the boats as before. Crying farewell, the elves of Lorien with long gray poles thrust them out into the flowing stream, and the rippling waters bore them slowly away. The travelers sat still without moving or speaking. On the green bank, near to the very point of the Tongue, the Lady Galadriel stood alone and silent. As they passed her, they turned, and their eyes watched her slowly floating away from them. For so it seemed to them, Lorien was slipping backwards. like a bright ship masted with enchanted trees, sailing on to forgotten shores, while they sat helpless upon the margin of the gray and leafless world. Even as they gazed, the silver load passed out into the currents of the great river, and their boats turned and began to speed southward. Soon the white form of the lady was small and distant. She shone like a window of glass upon a far hill in the westering sun, or as a remote lake seen from a mountain, a crystal fallen in the lap of the land. Then it seemed to Frodo that she lifted her arms in a final farewell, and far but piercing clear on the following wind came the sound of her voice singing. But now she sang in the ancient tongue of the elves beyond the sea, and she did not understand the words. Fair was the music, but it did not comfort him. Yet, as is the way of elvish words, they remained graven in his memory, and long afterwards he interpreted them, as well as he could. The language was that of elven song, and spoke of things little known on Middle-earth.
Ah, like gold falls the leaves in the wind, long years numberless as the wings of trees. The years have passed like swift drafts of sweet mead in lofty halls beyond the west, beneath the blue vaults of Varda, wherein the stars tremble in the song of her voice, holy and queenly. Who now shall refill the cup for me? For the kindler, Varda, the queen of the stars, and from Mount Everwhite has uplifted her hand like clouds. All paths are drowned deep in shadow. Out of a gray country, darkness lies on the foaming waves between us, and mists cover the jewels of Calicuria forever. Now lost to those from the east of Valimar. Farewell, maybe thou shalt find Valimar. Maybe even thou shalt find it. Farewell. Varda is the name of the lady for whom the elves in these lands of exile name Elbereth. Okay, so that was the end of Lothlorien chapters. Well, actually, we haven't finished this chapter yet, but Lothlorien mm-hmm. place. And that was our last goodbye to mm-hmm. Galadriel. What'd we think?
Melancholy, but...
Very.
We certainly built up to it. We've spent plenty of time discussing, and it's emphasized well in the book, the temporal and non-temporal nature of Lothlorien. How it's both trapped in time and stuck in this irreversible tide that Galadriel is mourning. So this seems like a very...
Yeah.
We expected it to end this way in some way.
But we went through this whole thing. I think I kind of promised in the Galadriel special that we'd kind of go over who / what inspired her creation. And honestly, I was pretty surprised that my books, all the books I was reading as supplement for this, none of them really sufficiently cover this at all, which I was surprised about that. So we're going to have to do our best here.
Okay.
So I was thinking, first thought that probably isn't correct thought, is she kind of like a really cool fairy godmother kind of character.
Okay.
You know, she's like doing all this magic stuff and she's giving them gifts and they're all like magical tokens and stuff, you know, and then she's changing their lives a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's one thought. Okay. Next one, is she some sort of like heavenly mother, you know, like the Virgin Mary, like kind of standing for her again, even though she's singing about Varda and Elbereth, who is already one clear example of that we've seen in Lord of the Rings.
Mm-hmm.
Readers sent letters to Tolkien about this, and he approved of that. I think that could make sense because Mary's like the archetypal mother, or like perfect mom. She literally actually was like the perfect mom. So that's one option. And then I was thinking about it, and maybe I also just want to cover this at some point, so we're going to do it here. Is real mom possibly an inspiration here? You know, like an idealized or like glorified version, like heavenly version of his own mom.
Interesting.
So here's what came across in my ideas right there, is clearly just a motherhood, right?
Okay, yeah.
I mean, would you agree with that?
In some ways, yes, because she's kind of got her like matriarchal domain over Lothlorien. As we were reading her history in the Silmarillion, she just comes off as a younger character in a lot of that, and yeah. Like a little bit more of like.
Don't think of the Silmarillion. Just think of just these chapters.
Okay.
What was she like in these chapters?
Yeah, sort of wise and serene. Almost like more grandmotherly, but yes, yeah. Wise to the ways of the world, very comforting, but also very direct. Like her ability to look into everyone's eyes and understand their thoughts. I feel like that you could easily imagine some people feeling like that about their mother's unique yeah. power to like understand what's happening with their children or their people, the people around them.
Yeah, okay, so I thought it might be like, I don't know, I'm kind of taking a stab in the dark that maybe this is Token's mom is really influential here. Token's mom, Mabel Token. So she died when he was like 9 or 10 years old, something around there. And he believed that she died as a martyr because she was super overworked trying to provide for her two kids because his dad had already died when he was 3. And so when she had converted to Catholicism, her whole family stopped supporting her. And so she had to like just fend for herself, like worked a job and like raise her 2 sons. And so it's during this time where in his adolescence that she's the one that's literally teaching him like the grammar school and everything. Like she's just teaching him. Like you don't send him somewhere else. You, when he gets to, I don't know, it seems like junior high time, then you can go to a real school. But like before that, you got to be prepped yourself so that you can actually get into the school and perform. And so it was, she was the one that was really fueling like all his creativity and like sending his mind spinning by exposing him to all sorts of fairy tales and like great works of art and everything, you know, which kind of feels like she's guiding him and teaching him. Just like Galadriel, she's definitely guiding them throughout these chapters, like clearly. And then Mary probably did this with Jesus in his childhood too. I think the mom and Mary are going to be good examples here.
I would also add on though to your comparison that in the story, Galadriel is like super independent. And we saw in the Silmarillion, forged her own pathway that was like very, very unique among all the elves, not really constrained by her family or her partner or what was going on around her. And Tolkien might have seen that in his own mother, especially the conversion to Catholicism against the will of her family could be like a strong inspiration.
You're right, Clifford. Nice, yeah, backing my point up more. Good. Just like a couple fun things since we're on notes about the mom too. She was definitely where he got his Tolkien's an artist. Like if you look up like J.R.R. Tolkien personal art, like if you find the real stuff, you'll probably know once you're looking at it because he's got like his own distinctive style and everything. Really good at landscapes, really good at making decorative design things. You know, he doesn't really do many like portraits of people and stuff, but like the landscapes and designs and like decorating up a picture, he's really good at it. This definitely came from her because she had fabulous penmanship. And this is funny too. It's because she came from a family for generations back. Historically, they were like engravers of like metals, you know, like,
oh, interesting,
like the words on metal. Yeah, so this is where Tolkien
his
got
style
from.
Is very engraving inspired. I'm looking at some images of it now. It's done in like the way that an engraving or an etching woodblock print or something like that would be done.
Yeah, it's super cool. There's a joke detail that comes through like most of the books that he had a different writing style for all of his friends when he would write them letters. Like each friend had a different style. Yeah, kind of cool. And then like you'll see it too. And if you look up just drafts of his stuff, like sometimes he goes like and makes like a real elaborate, nice, very beautifully clean, like way too beautiful for just like a draft of a page of Lord of the Rings. And then there's other times where it's literally chicken scratch because he's writing so fast just to get the idea down because it's probably late at night and he wants to go to bed, you know, but he wants to do it before he falls asleep. Of course, like I just said, the mom was also he considered her a martyr, and this was probably his first real impetus to begin taking his faith seriously. I mean, he's only like, he was on the verge of his teens at this point, so I don't know, you know, at that point you probably just do whatever your parents say when it comes to religion. But then now this is like one of his first experiences to like decide how committed he wants to be to that kind of thing. Not the only influence on that, because he would go throughout his whole life, you know, not really questioning his faith, but like committing and reevaluating his faith, you know, constantly as other influences come up, especially throughout like the middle of the 20th century, because there was lots of other stuff that you could follow. Anyways, yeah, and then like her death especially, and then probably additionally lots of his friends in World War One. This is probably where he came up with that very melancholic idea, like history is one long defeat, you know. And by history, I think that means like recorded time, you know. Eventually there will be a great victory, but it won't come in just the regular history of fallen men,
right,
as we talked about in the past episode. Yeah, I think Galadriel kind of represents the ideal mother, maybe grandmother, but then again, she's kind of young, so maybe not. I don't know. And yeah, maybe this is the heavenly version of Tolkien's own mom that he didn't...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That would be watching over him, possibly. Okay, this is a trait of a master writer here, or somebody that needs an editor. Chapter could have easily ended here.
Great options there.
Totally could have ended here with them just floating down the river and that's it. But Tolkien really hits us home with the pain of leaving Lothlorien with this last conversation.
Gimli wept openly. "I have looked the last upon that which was fairest," he said to Legolas, his companion. "Henceforward, I will call nothing fair, unless it be her gift." He put his hand to his breast. "Oh, sorry, that's still me. Tell me, Legolas, why did you come on this quest? Little did I know where the chief peril lay. Truly, Elrond spoke, saying that we could not foresee what we might meet upon our road. Torment in the dark was the danger that I feared, and it did not hold me back. But I would not have come had I known the danger of light and joy. Now I have taken my worst wound in this parting, even if I were to go this night straight to the Dark Lord. Alas for Gimli, son of Gloin."
"Nay," said Legolas, "alas for us all, and for all that walk in the world in these after days, for such is the way of it, to find and lose, as it seems to those whose boat is on the running stream. But I count you blessed, Gimli, son of Gloin, for your loss you suffer of your own free will, and you might have chosen otherwise, but you have not forsaken your companions, and the least reward that you shall have is that the memory of Lothlorien shall remain ever clear and unstained in your heart, and shall neither fade nor grow stale."
"Maybe," said Gimli, "and I thank you for your words. True words, doubtless, yet all such comfort is cold. Memory is not what the heart desires. That is only a mirror, be it clear as Kel Zaram, or so says the heart of Gimli the dwarf. Elves may see things otherwise. Indeed, I have heard that for them memory is more like to the waking world than to a dream. Not so for dwarves."
What do you think?
Well, a classic bit of banter between Gimli and Legolas, but this is probably weightier than most of their conversations.
And it's in the book. It's endearing too.
Yes. It drives home the sorrow, the disappointment of leaving, as you were saying. But it's also, I don't know, this is something that we see a lot, and I think of as like Tolkien, particularly with language, he sets up like these multiple languages, multiple words for things, multiple interpretations. And then this is like another example where he set up the fact, or he's alluding to the dwarves and elves remembering things in different ways. Like the way, like if he didn't have these different sort of species or races, creatures to work with, it might be some statement like, oh, well, some people are like this and some people remember things more thoroughly. But it's kind of an interesting like distinction between the worldview of elves and dwarves and then how like it even comes down to how the memories are kind of seared in their mind or not. It's an interesting detail, and it makes me, I'm tripping myself up.
Yeah.
It lends a different sort of tone to everything, because he's got this complexity of how things are interpreted differently by the different characters, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's not very singular. Even if a lot of the language sometimes makes things sound super singular, yeah, it's actually very grounded in every individual and their culture and their background.
Yeah, I mean, in Gimli here, I think the most stunning line of it all was like, hey, I was ready for a dark road here, you know, where we're going to face like torment and death and battles and everything. But if I had known the great beauty I'd have to walk away from, I would never have taken on this quest, you know.
That's kind of
a crazy idea. But then Legolas is applauding him that he's voluntarily leaving too, and he's not abandoning his companions in his quest, you know, and he's abandoning what was probably just the coolest place he's ever been, like ever, and
right,
ever will be. He, like, Legolas is basically saying too, like implying like, yeah, he had the option to just stay here forever, like he could have turned away and just lived here, you know, but he didn't, and he's gonna keep going on, which is noble, responsible, respectable, very cool of them. I also wanted to bring up too, like, just if we remember two chapters ago when they were entering Lorien, Boromir was real afraid to go in, and he was saying, like, I think the quote was, "But of that land we have heard in Gondor, and it is said few come out who once go in, and of that few none have escaped unscathed." And then Aragorn stops him and he says, "Say not unscathed, but if you say unchanged, then maybe you will speak the truth." Boromir's like, "Well, this is going to be a perilous land," and Aragorn is just like, "Perilous indeed, fair and perilous." But, you know, and it's like, well, now that we've come out of it, it's, damn, that kind of lived up to the bill, you know, especially look at how it affected Gimli. I mean, it affected Frodo too. Like, he was sad to leave. I mean, obviously they were all sad to leave,
you know? Right, but they've all been changed in a deeper way than just being sad about leaving.
Yeah, so I mean, this place lived up to the bill, which mm-hmm. is pretty sweet, because mm-hmm. this was a tall order, I'd say. You know, and then also I'd like to think too, I think a Gimli leaving, you know, and he had only been there for a few days and he's super miserable. Again, two chapters ago, Haldir's speech about how the elves of Lothlorien, they've been there thousands of years, and pretty soon they're going to have to leave permanently too. Whether they lose to Sauron or whether they beat Sauron and the rings are destroyed, then Lothlorien's going to basically kind of fade away.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so Gimli, yeah, been there a few days. Super sad.
Yeah.
Haldir, like, imagine that guy having to go across the sea. You know, he's going to be so bummed out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it sounds like Galadriel's kind of ready for it at this point herself, so that's one thing. But she is still probably tired, you know, sad that, you know, this world's coming to an end for her.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. What do you think? Here, just like a last short discussion just to finish this off. Do you think you could handle the high highs and the low lows of this chapter? Or would you just need something more even-keeled?
If I were one of the characters?
One of the low lows of this trip is that they just have to leave a really nice place, you know? Or, like, another low low is obviously Gandalf falling down, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the high highs is like, oh, you get to go to Rivendell, you get to go to Lothlorien, and you're like, this is super sweet, right? Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It'd
be pretty brutal, but are you saying would I rather opt for a less, a lower high so that it doesn't contrast so much with the misery of the rest of the journey?
Yeah, would you trade the highest highs to get rid of the lowest lows? And then you just have like a more just like bland.
I don't think so. Because I think it makes this like re-entry into the world extra brutal, but then that becomes like a motivating force later on. One, it's like this amazing memory seared in your mind that you just, I mean, probably the way your memory works, it becomes even better than it was the second you leave.
Yeah.
But also, like, in the kind of darkest moments ahead, that's your new standard of, like, the beauty of the world.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. But if I'm going to be totally honest, I would probably be hesitant. And I would, like, I would consider it, like, the high highs. I don't know if it really is worth the lowest lows, right? But I think you're right. And I think it's always good to embrace that, too, wherever you see it. Not just in these books where it makes good reading, but also, like, wherever it's applicable in your own life, mm-hmm. too. That's about all I got, because the chapter ends with them floating down the river and long into the night. You got anything else?
No, that's it.
Cool. All right. I think this is a cool one. This is a fun one. We might have a surprise for the next chapter. Stay tuned.
Okay. I will stay tuned.
Yeah, okay. All right, Clifford, we're back again. Let's keep this one short because I've had a long day.
Okay, fine by me.
How you been?
Been good. Busy as well, you know?
Yeah, let me see if I had some notes for this section about corrections.
Okay. While you're working on that, I'll say that I have started doing crossword puzzles, which I've done in the past, but haven't done in a little while, and I've started doing them, and now I'm addicted.
Crossword, okay, so crossword puzzles are actually pretty cool. They're not as cool as Jeopardy, but, you know.
They're fun, though. Like, I do them in the morning while I'm, like, eating breakfast.
You're built for crossword puzzles. Like, I don't think I'm made for that. I don't have the stuff for that. I got a good memory for trivia.
It's, like, a good mix of, like, puzzle, like, kind of puzzling the way you would have, like, a number puzzle. Like, you got to figure out clever solutions, but then it's also, you know, random history trivia.
So. Yeah, and I'll say this: crossword puzzles superior to Scrabble. Scrabble is only a step above Boggle, because Scrabble you only have 7-letter words. You never have more than 7 letters for Scrabble. So, like, that is very lame and limiting.
Scrabble's still a great game, though.
I mean, you'd say that because you win 90% of the time, so sure, whatever. I guess I'd say that too if I won 90% of the time. Scrabble's no chess, and chess, even chess, my beloved chess, is no Lord of the Rings Risk. The king of all board games, and that is not even biased that we're doing a Lord of the Rings podcast. that's just facts, because they have the Violent Storms card, which by house rules wipes out all armies. When I get that card, I try to wipe out as big an army as I can. I don't try to win the game. I just try to kill the biggest army. And I killed 120 guys once. I don't know how we got to there, or from crossword puzzles.
A violent storm arrived. I don't even know what happened.
Dude, this weekend, I watched a really great movie, which you guys will hear about when we get to a later episode. I think Clifford did too.
That is correct.
I love that movie. I can't wait to talk about it. Okay, and then last thing. Hey, I said we're doing a special that's going to, like, the jumping off points about Lembas Bread. It's not going to be out this week because Morgan can't get the drawing in. Plus, I'm a bit swamped because we did, like, the Galadriel special. Whenever I have to do specials, it adds a lot to the workload because it just comes up midweek. So it'll be out not this weekend, but the weekend after, FYI, if you're at the edge of your seat somehow waiting for that. But it is an interesting one, so get ready.
Did you have any corrections?
Nope, that was it.
Okay, cool.
Okay. Yeah, let's leave it here because we got a lot to do.
Okay. Thanks, y'all.